Conrad Berg ran heavily over the broken sandy ground. He had lost his hat, and sweat poured down his big red face, stinging his eyes and plastering the lank grey hair down his forehead. The walkie-talkie set bounced on his back, and the butt of the rifle thumped rhythmically against his hip. He ran with grim concentration, trying to ignore the swollen pounding of his heart and the torture of breath that scalded his lungs. A thorn branch clawed at his upper arms, raking thin bloody lines through his skin, but he did not break the pattern of his run. He turned his red and streaming face to the sky and saw David's aircraft circling ahead of him and slightly to his left. That marked for him Ucker's position, and it was clear that Conrad was losing ground in his desperate race to head off the escape. The radio set on his back buzzed, but he ignored the call. He could not halt now. To break his run would mean he would only slump down exhausted. He was a big, heavy man. The air was hot and enervating, and he had run 3 miles through loose and difficult going. He was almost finished. He was burning the last of his reserves now. Suddenly, the earth seemed to fall away under him, and he pitched forward and half-slid, half-rolled down the steep bank of the Luzzani stream, to finish lying on his back in the white river sand, clean and grainy as sugar. The radio was digging painfully into his flesh, and he dragged it out from under him. Still lying in the sand, he panted like a dog, blinded by sweat, and he fumbled the transmit button of the set.
"David," he croaked thickly, "I'm in the bed of the stream. Can you see me?"
The aircraft was arcing directly overhead now, and David's answer came back immediately.
"I see you, Connie. You're 100 yards downstream from the truck. Ucker's is there, Connie. He's just reached the truck. He'll be coming back down the riverbed at any moment."
Painfully, gasping, choking for breath, Conrad Berg dragged himself to his knees. And at that moment he heard the whir and catch and purr of an engine. He unstrapped the heavy radio and laid it aside. Then he unslung his rifle, snapped open the breech to check the load, and pulled himself to his feet. Surprised at the weakness of his own massive body, he staggered into the center of the riverbed. The dry riverbed was 8 feet deep, with banks cut sheer by floodwater, and it was 15 feet wide at this point. And the floor was of smooth white sand, scattered with small water-rounded stones no bigger than a baseball. It made a good illegal access road into Jabulani, and the tracks of Ucker's truck were clearly etched in the soft sand. Around a bend in the stream, Conrad heard the truck revving and roaring as it came down a low place in the bank into the smooth bed. Conrad stood squarely in the middle of the riverbed, with the rifle held across his hip, and he fought to control his breathing. The approaching roar of the truck reached a crescendo as it came skidding wildly around the bend in the stream and raced down towards him. Showers of loose sand were thrown out from under the spinning rear wheels. Johann Ucker's crouched over the steering wheel, with the black hat pulled down to his eyebrows, and his face was grey and glistening with sweat, and he saw Conrad blocking the riverbed. "Stop!" Conrad shouted, hefting the rifle. "Stop or I shoot!" The truck was swaying and sliding. The engine screamed in tortured protest. Ucker's began to laugh. Conrad could see the open mouth and the shaking shoulders. There was no slackening in the truck's roaring, rocking charge. Conrad lifted the rifle and sighted down the stubby double barrels. At that range, he could have put a bullet through each of Johann Ucker's deep-set eyes, and the man made no effort to duck or otherwise avoid the menace of the leveled rifle. He was still laughing, and Conrad could clearly see the teeth lying loosely on his gums. He steeled himself with the truck 50 feet away and racing down upon him. It takes a peculiar state of mind before one man can deliberately and cold-bloodedly shoot down another. It must either be the conditioned reflex of the soldier or law enforcement officer, or it must be the terror of the hunted, or again it must be the unbalanced frenzy of the criminal lunatic. None of these was Conrad Berg. Like most big, strong men, he was essentially a gentle person. His whole thinking was centered on protecting and cherishing life. He could not pull the trigger. With the truck 15 feet away, he threw himself aside, and Johann Ucker swung the wheel wildly, deliberately driving for him. He caught Berg a glancing blow with the side of the truck, hurling him into the earthen bank of the stream. The truck went past him, slewing out of control. It hit the bank further down the stream in a burst of earth and loose pebbles, swaying wildly as Uckers fought the bucking wheel. He got it under control again, jammed his foot down on the accelerator, and went roaring on down the riverbed, leaving Conrad lying in the soft sand below the bank. As the truck hit him, Conrad felt the bone in his hip shatter like glass, and the breath driven from his lungs by the heavy blow of metal against his ribcage. He lay in the sand on his side and felt the blood well slowly into his mouth. It had a bitter salt taste, and he knew that one of the broken ribs had pierced his lung like a lance, and that the blood sprang from deep within his body. He turned his head and saw the radio set lying 10 paces away across the riverbed. He began to drag himself towards it, and his shattered legs slithered after him, twisted at a grotesque angle.
"David," he whispered into the microphone. "I couldn't stop him. He got away."
And he spat a mouthful of blood into the white sand. David picked the truck up as it came charging up the riverbank below the concrete bridge of the Luzzani, bounced and bumped over the drainage ditch, and swung onto the road. It gathered speed swiftly and raced westwards towards Bandelier Hill and the highway. Dust boiled out from behind the green chassis, marking its position clearly for David as he turned 2 miles ahead of it. After crossing the Luzzani, the road turned sharply to avoid a rocky outcrop and then ran arrow straight for 2 miles, hedged in with thick timber and undulating like a switchback, striking across the watershed and the grain of the land. As David completed his turn, he lowered his landing gear and throttled back. The Navajo sank down, lined up on the dusty road as though it was a landing strip. Directly ahead was the dust column of the speeding truck. They were on a head-on course, but David concentrated coldly on bringing the Navajo down into the narrow lane between the high walls of timber. He was speaking quietly to Deborah, reassuring her and explaining what he was going to attempt. He touched down lightly on the narrow road, letting her float in easily, and when she was down, he opened the throttles again, taking her along the center of the road under power, but holding her down. He had speed enough to lift the Navajo off if Uckers chose a collision rather than surrender. Ahead of them was another hump in the road, and as they rolled swiftly towards it, the green truck suddenly burst over the crest, not more than 100 yards ahead. Both vehicles were moving fast, coming together at a combined speed of almost 200 miles an hour, and the shock of it was too much for Johann Uckers. The appearance of the aircraft, dead in the center of the road, bearing down on him with the terrible spinning discs of the propellers, was too much for nerves already run raw and ragged. He wrenched the wheel hard over, and the truck went into a broadside dry skid. It missed the port wingtip of the Navajo as it went rocketing off the narrow road. The front wheels caught the drainage ditch, and the truck went over, cartwheeling twice in vicious slamming revolutions that smashed the glass from her windows and burst the doors open. The truck ended on its side against one of the trees. David shut the throttles and thrust his feet hard down on the wheel brakes, bringing the Navajo up short. "Wait here," he shouted at Deborah, and jumped down into the road. His face was a frozen mask of scar tissue, but his eyes were ablaze as he sprinted back along the road towards the wreckage of the green truck. Uckers saw him coming, and he dragged himself shakily to his feet. He had been thrown clear, and now he staggered to the truck. He could see his rifle lying in the cab, and he tried to scramble up onto the body to reach down through the open door. Blood from a deep scratch in his forehead was running into his eyes, blinding him. He wiped it away with the back of his hand and glanced around. David was close, hurdling the irrigation ditch and running towards him. Uckers scrambled down from the battered green body and groped for the hunting knife on his belt. It was 8 inches of Sheffield steel with a bone handle, and it had been honed to a razor edge. He hefted it underhanded, in the classical grip of the knife fighter, and wiped the blood from his face with the palm of his free hand. He was crouching slightly, facing David, and the haft of the knife was completely covered by the huge bony fist. David stopped short of him, his eyes fastened on the knife, and Uckers began to laugh again. It was a cracked falsetto giggle, the hysterical laughter of a man driven to the very frontiers of sanity. The point of the knife weaved in the slow, mesmeric movement of an erect cobra, and it caught the sunlight in bright points of light. David watched it, circling and crouching, steeling himself, summoning all the training of paratrooper school, screwing up his nerve to go in against the naked steel. Uckers fainted swiftly, leaping in, and when David broke away, he let out a fresh burst of high laughter. Again they circled, Uckers mouthing his teeth loosely, sucking at them, giggling, watching with those muddy green eyes from their deep, close-set sockets. David moved back slowly ahead of him, and Uckers drove him back against the body of the truck, cornering him there. He came then, flashing like the charge of a wounded leopard. His speed and strength were shocking, and the knife hissed upwards for David's belly. David caught the knife hand at the wrist, blocking the thrust and trapping the knife low down. They were chest to chest now, face to face like lovers, and Uckers' breath stank of unwashed teeth. They strained silently, shifting like dancers to balance each other's heaves and thrusts. David felt the knife hand twisting in his grip. The man had hands and arms like steel. He could not hold him much longer. In seconds it would be free, and the steel would be probing into his belly. David braced his legs and twisted sideways. The move caught Uckers off balance, and he could not resist it. David was able to get his other hand onto the knife arm, but even with both hands he was hard put to hold on. They swayed and shuffled together, panting, grunting, straining, until they fell, still locked together, against the bonnet of the truck. The metal was hot and smelled of oil. David was concentrating all his strength on the knife, but he felt Uckers' free hand groping for his throat. He ducked his head down on his shoulders, pressing his chin against his chest, but the fingers were steel-hard and powerful as machinery. They probed mercilessly into his flesh, forcing his chin up, and settling on his throat, beginning to squeeze the life out of him. Desperately, David hauled at the knife arm and found it more manageable now that Uckers was concentrating his strength on strangling him. The open windscreen of the truck was beside David's shoulder. The glass had been smashed out of it, but jagged shards of it still stood in the metal rim, forming a crude but ferocious line of sore teeth. David felt the fingers digging deep into his throat, crushing the gristle of his larynx and blocking off the arteries that fed his brain. His vision starred and then began to fade darkly, as though he were pulling 8 G's in a dogfight. With one last explosive effort, David pulled the knife arm around onto the line of the broken glass, and he dragged it down, sawing it desperately across the edge. Uckers screamed, and his strangling grip relaxed. Back and forth David sawed the arm, slashing and ripping through the skin and fat and flesh, opening a wound like a ragged petaled rose, hacking down into the nerves and arteries and sinews so that the knife dropped from the lifeless fingers, and Uckers screamed like a woman. David broke from him and shoved him away. Uckers fell to his knees, still screaming, and David clutched at his own throat, massaging the bruised flesh, gasping for breath and feeling the flow of fresh blood to his brain.
God Jesus, I'm dying! I'm bleeding to death! Oh, sweet Jesus, help me!
Screamed Uckers, holding the mutilated arm to his belly.
Help me, oh God, don't let me die! Save me, Jesus, save me!
Blood was streaming and spurting from the arm, flooding the front of his trousers. As he screamed, his teeth fell from his mouth, leaving it a dark and empty cave in the palely glistening face.
You've killed me, I'll bleed to death!
He screamed at David, thrusting his face towards David.
You've got to save me, don't let me die!
David pushed himself away from the truck and took 2 running steps towards the kneeling man. Then he swung his right leg and his whole body into a flying kick that took Uckers cleanly under the chin and snapped his head back. He went over backwards and lay still and quiet, and David stood over him, sobbing and gasping for breath. For purposes of sentence, Mr. Justice Barnard of the Transvaal Division of the Supreme Court took into consideration 4 previous convictions, 2 under the Wildlife Conservation Act, 1 for aggravated assault, and the 4th for assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm. He found Johan Uckers guilty of 12 counts under the Wildlife Conservation Act, but considered these as one when sentencing him to 3 years at hard labour without option of a fine and confiscation of firearms and motor vehicles used in commission of these offences. He found him guilty of one count of aggravated assault and sentenced him to 3 years at hard labour without option. The prosecutor altered one charge from attempted murder to assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm. He was found guilty as charged on this count, and the sentence was 5 years imprisonment without option. On the final charge of murder, he was found guilty, and Justice Barnard said in open court, "In considering sentence of death on this charge, I was obliged to take into account the fact that the accused was acting like an animal in a trap, and I am satisfied that there was no element of premeditation." The sentence was 18 years imprisonment, and all sentences were to run consecutively. They were all confirmed on appeal. As Conrad Berg said from his hospital bed with one heavily plastered leg in traction and a glass of old Buck gin in his hand, "Well, for the next 28 years, we don't have to worry about that bastard. Oh, I beg your pardon, Mrs. Morgan."
29 years, dear,"
Jane Berg corrected him firmly. In July, the American edition of A Place of Our Own was published, and it dropped immediately into that hungry and bottomless pool of indifference wherein so many good books drown. It left not a sign, not a ripple of its passing. Bobby Duggan, Deborah's new literary agent in America, wrote to say how sorry he was and how disappointed. He had expected at least some sort of critical notice to be taken of the publication. David took it as a personal and direct insult. He ranted and stormed about the estate for a week, and it seemed that at one stage he might actually journey to America to commit a physical violence upon that country, a sort of one-man Vietnam in reverse. "They must be stupid," he protested. "It's the finest book ever written."
"Oh, David," Deborah protested modestly.
"It is, and I'd love to go over there and rub their noses in it." And Deborah imagined the doors of editorial offices all over New York being kicked open, and literary reviewers fleeing panic-stricken, jumping out of skyscraper windows or locking themselves in the women's toilets to evade David's wrath. "David, my darling, you're wonderful for me," she giggled with delight. But it had hurt. It had hurt very badly. She felt the flame of her urge to write wane and flutter in the chill winds of rejection. Now, when she sat at her desk, with the microphone at her lips, the words no longer tumbled and fought to escape, and the ideas no longer jostled each other. Where before she had seen things happening as though she were watching a play, seen her characters laugh and cry and sing, now there was only the dark cloud banks rolling across her eyes, unrelieved by colour or form. For hours at a time she might sit at her desk and listen to the birds in the garden below the window. David sensed her despair, and he tried to help her through it. When the hours at the desk proved fruitless, he would insist she leave it and come with him along the new fence lines, or to fish for the big blue Mozambique bream in the deep water of the pools. Now that she had completely learned the layout of the house and its immediate environs, David began to teach her to find her way at large. Each day they would walk down to the pools, and Deborah learned her landmarks along the track. She would grope for them with the carved walking stick David had given her. Zulu soon realized his role in these expeditions, and it was David's idea to clip a tiny silver bell onto his collar so that Deborah could follow him more readily. Soon she could venture out without David, merely calling her destination to Zulu and checking him against her own landmarks. David was busy at this time with the removal of Conrad's game fence, as he was still laid up with the leg, and with building his own fences to enclose the three vulnerable boundaries of Jabulani. In addition, there was a force of African rangers to recruit and train in their duties. David designed uniforms for them and built outposts for them at all the main access points to the estate. He flew into Nelspruit at regular intervals to consult Conrad Berg on these arrangements, and it was at his suggestion that David began a water survey of the estate. He wanted surface water on the areas of Jabulani that were remote from the pools, and he began studying the feasibility of building catchment dams or sinking boreholes. His days were full and active, and he became hard and lean and sunbrowned. Yet always there were many hours spent in Deborah's company. The 35mm color slides that David had taken of the buffalo herd before Johann Akers had decimated it were returned by the processing laboratory, and they were hopelessly inadequate. The huge animals seemed to be standing on the horizon, and the oxpeckers on their bodies were tiny gray specks. This failure spurred David, and he returned from one trip to Nelspruit with a 600mm telescopic lens. While Deborah was meant to be working, David set up his camera beside her and photographed the birds through her open window. The first results were mixed. Out of 36 exposures, 35 could be thrown away, but one was beautiful. A grey-headed bushshrike at the moment of flight, poised on spread wings with the sunlight catching his vivid plumage and his sparkling eye. David was hooked by the photography bug, and there were more lenses and cameras and tripods until Deborah protested that it was a hobby which was completely visual and from which she was excluded. David had one of his inspirations of genius. He sent away for pressings of June Stannard's birdsong recordings, and Deborah was enchanted. She listened to them intently, her whole face lighting with pleasure when she recognized a familiar call. From there, it was a natural step for her to attempt to make her own bird recordings, which included the tinkle of Zulu's silver bell, the buzz of David's Land Rover, the voices of the servants arguing in the kitchen yard, and faintly, very faintly, the chatter of a glossy starling. "It's no damn good," Deborah complained bitterly. "I wonder how she got hers so clear and close." David did some reading and built a parabolic reflector for her. It did not look particularly lovely, but it worked. Aimed at a sound source, it gathered and directed the sound waves into the microphone. From the window of Deborah's study, they became more adventurous and moved out. He built permanent and comfortable hides beside the drinking places at the pools, and when his rangers reported a nesting site of an interesting bird species, they would build temporary blinds of thatch and canvas, sometimes on tall stilts, where David and Deborah spent many silent and enjoyable hours together, shooting film and catching sound. Even Zulu learned to lie still and silent, with his bell removed on these occasions. Slowly they had begun to build up a library of photographs and recordings of a professional standard, until at last David plucked up sufficient courage to send to African Wildlife magazine a selection of a dozen of his best slides. 2 weeks later, he received a letter of acceptance with a check for $100. This payment represented a return of approximately 1/20% of his capital outlay on equipment. David was ecstatic, and Deborah's pleasure almost as great as his. They drank 2 bottles of Veuve Clicquot for dinner, and under the spell of excitement and champagne, their lovemaking that night was particularly inventive. When David's photographs were published in Wildlife, accompanied by Deborah's text, they reaped an unexpected harvest of letters from persons of similar interest all over the world, and a request from the editors for a full-length illustrated article on Jabalani and the Morgans' plans for turning it into a game sanctuary. Deborah made a lovely model for David's photographs that he compiled for the article, and she also worked with care on the text while David fed her ideas and criticism. Deborah's new book lay abandoned, but her disappointment was forgotten in the pleasure of working together. Their correspondence with other conservationists provided them with sufficient intellectual stimulus, and the occasional company of Conrad Berg and Jane satisfied their need for human contact. They were still both sensitive about being with other people, and this way they could avoid it. The Wildlife article was almost complete and ready for posting, when a letter arrived from Bobby Duggan in New York. The editor of Cosmopolitan magazine had chanced upon one of the few copies of A Place of Our Own in circulation. She had liked it, and the magazine was considering serialization of the book, possibly linked with a feature article on Deborah. Bobby wanted Deborah to let him have a selection of photographs of herself and 4,000 words of autobiographical notes. The photographs were there, ready to go to Wildlife, and Deborah ran through the 4,000 words in 3 hours with David making suggestions, some helpful and some bawdy. They sent off the tape and pictures in the same post as the article to Wildlife. For nearly a month, they heard nothing more about it, and then something happened to drive it from their minds. They were in the small thatch and daub hide beside the main pool, sitting quietly and companionably during a lull in the evening activity. David had his camera tripod set up in one of the viewing windows, and Deborah's reflector was raised above the roof of the hide, daubed with camouflage paint and operated by a handle above her head. The water was still and black, except where a surface feeding bream was rising near the far reed banks. A flock of laughing doves was lining up with a chittering troop of spotted guinea fowl at the water's edge, sipping water and then pointing their beaks to the sky as they let it run down their throats. Suddenly, David took her wrist as a cautionary signal, and by the intensity of his grip, she knew that he had seen something unusual, and she leaned close against him so that she could hear his whispered descriptions, and with her right hand, she switched on the recorder and then reached up to aim the reflector. A herd of the rare and shy Inyala antelope were approaching the drinking place timidly, clinging until the last possible moment to the security of the forest. Their ears were spread, and their nostrils quivered and sucked at the air, huge dark eyes glowing like lamps in the gloom. There were 9 hornless females, delicate chestnut in color, striped with white, dainty stepping and suspicious as they followed the 2 herd bulls. These were so dissimilar from their females as though to belong to a different species. Purplish black and shaggy, with a rough mane extending from between the ears to the crupper. Their horns were thick and corkscrewed, tipped with cream, and between their eyes was a vivid white chevron marking. Advancing only a step at a time, and then pausing to stare with the limitless patience of the wild, searching for a hint of danger, they came slowly down the bank. They passed the hide so closely that David was afraid to press the trigger of his camera, lest the click of the shutter frighten them away. He and Deborah sat frozen as they reached the water. Deborah smiled happily as she picked up the soft snort with which the lead bull blew the surface before drinking, and the liquid slurping with which he drew his first mouthful. Once they were all drinking, David aimed and focused with care, but at the click of the shutter, the bull nearest him leapt about and uttered a hoarse, throbbing alarm bark. Instantly, the entire herd whirled and raced away like pale ghosts through the dark trees. "I got it! I got it!" exulted Deborah. "Wow, he was so close, he nearly burst my eardrums." The excitement on Jabalani was feverish. Nyala antelope had never been seen on the estate before, not even in David's father's time, and all steps were taken to encourage them to remain. The pools were immediately placed out of bounds to all the rangers and servants, lest the human presence frighten the herd off before they had a chance to settle down and stabilize their territory.